stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. On this week's The Space Show, the Artemis 1 mission. What is it? Well, Mike Serafin is the mission manager, and he has a summary of this moon flight and its priorities. What science will it do? Well, Bhavya Lal is an associate administrator at NASA, and she describes the small satellites to be released and the mannequins that will fly beyond the moon inside the Orion capsule. And NASA's lead lunar scientist, Sarah Noble, outlines the progress in lunar science. And from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pam Clark tells us how she will look for evidence of water on the moon. Craig Hargrave at the Arizona State University will be looking for hydrogen at the lunar poles, because hydrogen is one of the elements making up water. At the University of Adelaide, Gordon Cable is a specialist in aerospace medicine, and in a talk here in Melbourne discussed the biomedical aspects of moon flights.
If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon. If you believe.
In Greek mythology, Leto and Zeus were the parents of twins, Apollo and Artemis. More than half a century ago, when the United States Space Agency was searching for a name for their planned manned lunar spacecraft, they settled on the name Apollo. Recently, when planning to resume human flights to the moon, NASA chose to name the project after Apollo's twin sister, Artemis. All going well, the first Artemis flight will be launched at the end of this month. This will be an unmanned test flight of the Space Launch System rocket and the Orion capsule. To mark this Artemis 1 mission, the Space Show will have a series of programs and will dispatch our very own reporter to Florida to cover the launch. Now, Mike Serafin is the Artemis 1 mission manager at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. And on August the 3rd, he gave this summary of the mission and listed the priorities to be achieved by the test flight.
Rollout will occur in about 2 weeks, and that'll signal that launch is near. The entire mobile launch tower, as well as the rocket and the spacecraft, will head out to the launch pad together and be positioned at Launch Complex 39B over a flame trench. We'll load it with cryo, fuel and oxidizer into the core stage as well as the upper stage. And when all systems are go, we'll give the go for launch and Artemis 1 will begin. The 32-story tall rocket will climb its way up through the atmosphere, and in 2 minutes all the solid propellant and the boosters will be consumed and jettisoned, as well as all the liquid fuel in 8 minutes, and the core stage will be jettisoned. The upper stage, as well as the Orion spacecraft, will then proceed in one lap around the Earth. Orion will deploy its solar rays and get off of battery power, and then we'll commit to the moon at the point of translunar injection. At that point, the rocket has done its job, and now Orion is on its way to the moon. At its closest point, Orion will be just 62 miles from the surface of the moon, and its farthest point, it'll be 38,000 miles past the far side of the moon, which is 250,000 miles away. When we return to the Earth, the European Service Module will be jettisoned. It will have done its job, and Orion will set up for its primary objective, which is Earth reentry. After the peak heating period, the parachutes will deploy, and the spacecraft will splash down the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California, where a U.S. Navy team and NASA team will receive the awaiting spacecraft. We'll retrieve all the data off of it, and that will inform our readiness as well as help us understand our ability to fly astronauts on the very next mission on Artemis 2. So those are some of the highlights you can expect. We intend to bring each and every one of you along throughout the course of the mission. We will share imagery both from the ground as well as the launch vehicle and the spacecraft throughout. Our primary objectives for the mission, we've got four primary objectives. Priority one is to demonstrate the spacecraft's ability to re-enter at lunar re-entry conditions. We need the rocket to do its job in order to set up those initial conditions. So all that chemical energy that's stored in the solid boosters and liquid fuel that's stored in the core stage and the upper stage needs to be delivered to the spacecraft and put in the form of kinetic and potential energy. And then the heat shield will take that back out through aerodynamic drag as it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere. That's priority number one. Priority number two is to demonstrate the vehicle in the flight environment. That is all the way from the launch pad, all the way out to the moon, and back to Earth. In order to do that, we need to demonstrate the rocket's ability to lift off safely from the launch pad. That 8.8 million pounds of thrust is going to reflect off the launch pad and bounce back up in terms of vibroacoustic shock. We have water sound suppression that is there to dampen that shock as the rocket lifts off. We also have these umbilical arms that are roughly the length of a tractor trailer and weigh thousands of pounds that need to retract in those initial moments at liftoff at first motion and clear the path of the rocket as it accelerates up off the launch pad. As we head up through the atmosphere, we're going to go through the period of maximum aerodynamic loading, or max-Q. The rocket and the spacecraft need to survive the ascent environment. And then all the separation events. We'll jettison the boosters. We will jettison the service module fairings that are an aerodynamic shell that cover the solar arrays during the Earth ascent. We'll jettison the launch abort system. And then we'll jettison the core stage. All these things need to work perfectly and in sequence in order to put Orion on its way to the moon. We'll demonstrate the propulsion systems to perform the translunar injection maneuver, as well as the ability of Orion to enter a lunar orbit and then return from lunar orbit. We'll communicate with assets that are beyond what we use for low Earth orbit and terrestrial users. Low Earth orbit and terrestrial users typically use the tracking and data relay satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit. They typically use the global positioning navigation system that is halfway to geosynchronous orbit. We're going to communicate and navigate using the deep space network, radiometric tracking, and optical navigation. We are also going to fly out through the Earth's Van Allen radiation belts. We will no longer be afforded the ability to have the Earth's magnetic field shield us from the deep space environment. So we're going to fly into the deep space high radiation environment, and we'll experience what it's like for our astronauts to fly on subsequent missions under those conditions. So that's priority two, demonstrate the spacecraft and the launch vehicle's ability in the flight environment. Priority three is to simply retrieve the spacecraft. We get the high-precision avionics on board for programmatic cost savings and reflight on later flights. We also get the spacecraft structure back for environmental testing on later flights. And then we get all the data that's recorded on board. We're going to have a blackout period during peak heating. A plasma field is going to envelope the spacecraft during reentry, and we will not be able to communicate with it. So the telemeter data that would normally come to Earth is not going to be able to be received on the ground during that period. So we're going to get all this data back to help us understanding our engineering uncertainties as well as what the flight environment was like from launch to splashdown. That's priority three. And then priority four is to perform some payload objectives. It is to perform outreach and share remarkable images with each and every one of you. Images that include Orion taking selfies down the solar array wings of itself in the foreground, the moon in the background, and the Earth a quarter million miles away.
That was Mike Serafin, the Artemis 1 mission manager. Also at NASA headquarters is Bhavya Lal. She is the Associate Administrator for Technology, Policy and Strategy. And she described the CubeSats, the mannequins, the radiation experiments, and the strange thing called Callisto Assistant. Can't wait to hear what that is.
So in addition to the primary objective that Mike outlined, there's a number of secondary payloads, investigations, and instruments riding along on the SLS, as well as inside the Orion capsule objective 4, as Mike said. These payloads reflect partnerships from across the agency with U.S. universities, our international partners, in fact, 5 of them. And these experiments are a perfect illustration of how collaboration will take us farther when we work together to build the knowledge towards our shared goals. So on to the payloads. On Artemis 1, we have 10 CubeSats riding along with SLS. Each CubeSat is about the size of a small suitcase, briefcase, or a shoebox even, and weighs about 25 pounds. These lightweight platforms enable us to conduct research at lower cost, but higher risk. Of course, that is the point. When it comes to CubeSats, failure is an option. Several of the CubeSats chosen to fly on Artemis 1 focus on lunar science and may help inform research strategies and prioritize technology development of human and robotic exploration. There are other payloads as well. CubeSats will be testing innovative propulsion technologies, studying space weather, analyzing the effects of radiation on living organisms, one of my favorite experiments, and providing high-resolution imagery of the Earth and Moon. Artemis 1 provides a rare opportunity for these small experiments to reach deep space destinations. As you all know, most CubeSat destinations tend to be low Earth orbit or LEO. But CubeSats aren't the only science experiments Artemis 1 is carrying. We have other experiments inside the Orion capsule that will prepare us for a permanent foothold in space. Inside Orion, although we do not have astronauts in this flight, we will have a few purposeful passengers who will help us understand the effects of space on the human body. A suited mannequin by the name of Commander Munikin Campos, the name was determined through a public survey, will occupy the commander's seat. And the idea is to provide data on the forces and loads the crew members may experience in flight. It heartens me to tell you that the name Campos is a dedication to Arturo Campos, who was instrumental in bringing Apollo 13 safely back to Earth. Other experiments, so as Orion travels beyond the protection of Earth's magnetic field, it will be exposed to a harsher radiation environment than crews aboard the International Space Station experience. Mike mentioned the Van Allen belts. Outside the Van Allen belts, the radiation environment includes solar energetic particles, events produced by sun during solar flares, and particles from outside the galaxy, galactic cosmic radiation. As a card-carrying nuclear engineer, I can personally attest that radiation is one of the top challenges for human exploration beyond LEO, which is why there is such a focus on understanding the radiation environment to and at the moon. And of course, many of you know, radiation affects women differently than it does men. So in the Orion capsule, we will have two adult female mannequin torsos, Helga and Zohar, that are part of an experiment to study the radiation environment and test a very cool radiation protection vest. I hope you have a chance to look at some of these pictures. They are fantastic. And finally, we have a demo on Orion that reminds me of, what else? Star Trek. The crew of Star Trek was always conversing with the ship's computer that was answering back. Well, the crew of the Artemis may be talking to the ship's computers as well. Orion will carry a technology demonstration payload called Callisto, named after one of Artemis's hunting companions in Greek mythology, to test the technology for a voice-activated virtual assistant. We'll start with commands like turning on or off lights remotely, something we do at home. But this could lead to the technology that eventually turns science fiction into reality on future crewed missions. What we are doing now is not simply returning to the moon as a mission of flags and footprints. We are beginning, as Administrator Nelson said, a long-term journey of science and exploration to the edge of the universe. We have done our early reconnaissance with both robots and humans. Now we are learning what we need to know to be able to spend more time at the moon and then prepare for going to Mars and beyond. Giant steps are what you take, walking on the moon. I hope my leg don't break, walking on.
One of 10 small satellites to be released from the first Space Launch System rocket will be the Near-Earth Asteroid Scout. When first designed in 2014, the project scientists and engineers had no specific target in mind. Their objective was to design a low-cost solar sail that could use solar photons to propel it to an asteroid. In 2016, it was one of 13 CubeSats selected to fly on the maiden flight of the SLS, which then was expected to fly in 2018. The SLS will now fly later this month, but with only 10 CubeSats. NEA Scout is one of the survivors. After deployment in cislunar space, NEA Scout will deploy its solar panels and antenna. Following a lunar flyby, four 6.8-metre booms will deploy the single 85-square-metre aluminized polyimide solar sail. Now, that sail is only 2.5 micrometres thick. Now, here is the strange thing. When NEA Scout was designed and then approved, the target asteroid had not even been discovered. As its name, Asteroid 2020 GE, suggests, this body was not discovered until March the 12th of 2020. Observations from Earth-based observatories show that 2020 GE is less than 18 meters in size and that its orbit around the Sun brings it close to the Earth. The plan is for NEA Scout to fly by 2020 GE at a distance of 1 kilometer at a relative speed of less than 30 meters per second. That flyby will be in September next year, as 2020 GE makes a close approach to Earth. Should the Artemis 1 launch be delayed, then another asteroid will be the target of NEA Scout's attention. Well, now to Sarah Noble. She's the lead lunar scientist at the Planetary Science Division at NASA headquarters. And in April of last year, she discussed the progress in lunar science.
I just wanted to start out by talking about, you know, just reflecting a little on like what a great time it is right now to be a lunar scientist. We have so much going on, right? From orbit, LRO, Themis, Artemis up there still doing their things, going strong. We have some CubeSats that are coming up. We've got these CLPS missions twice a year. We've got Viper coming up, and we've got the ANCSA folks in the lab learning lessons from Apollo. So, you know, left and right, everywhere you look, it's raining moons, which is awesome. It's a great time to be a lunar scientist. A little bit on Viper. Viper is moving forward. It is difficult to build a mission in the middle of a pandemic that has been challenging. And on top of that, I feel like this poor team, right? They've had to deal with wildfires in California. They've had to deal with floods and power outages in Houston. Sometimes it feels like, you know, Mother Nature is conspiring specifically against Viper, but the team is moving forward. They're doing great. They passed their KDPC in February, which is great. It means that they have now been confirmed officially as a mission, and they're still on track. They're moving forward to get to the moon at the end of 2023. Simplex, like I said, we've got some small sats that we're working on. So LunaMap from the Simplex 1 Roses call is planning to launch on Artemis 1, and they are just about ready to deliver, I think expected in June, so good progress on that team. Trailblazer is our Simplex 2 AO collection. They are also doing great. They also just recently passed their KDPC in November, and they're looking to get a ride share with IMAP. That's actually a heliophysics mission, so we like to partner with the other divisions every chance we get. Note that we actually just had selections for participating scientists for the Korean Pathfinder Lunar Orbiter mission. This is Korea's first deep space mission. They're looking to launch about just over a year. A little bit of update on ANCSA. ANCSA, our Apollo Next Generation Sample Analysis Programs. This is a program looking at some specially curated Apollo samples, and in particular, some that have never been looked at before, including a double drive tube where the lower half of the drive tube actually was sealed on the lunar surface. It's one of our three remaining lunar samples that haven't yet been opened. We have now opened the top half of that drive tube, not the sealed half, but the upper half, which hadn't been opened. We opened it just before the pandemic hit. And so we had just started to get some samples out, the very earliest samples, and then they sort of got shuttered. but they have been able to get back in the lab late last year. They were able to get back in the lab and start processing again. And so now those samples have started to go out to the team, and they are working hard on them. There were special sessions at both AGU and LPSC with some of their first results, some really exciting stuff coming out in science, and also in terms of lessons learned about how we curate things. And whether, you know, the way we did it during Apollo is the right way or not. And so that's some good things too. And we are working on getting that lower core opened. It's you know, it's a delicate thing. You can only do it once. And so we're being very sort of cautious and careful. We're working with ESA to develop a gas extraction tool so that we can pull those gases out that have been hopefully saved in there since they were on the moon. That tool should be delivered this summer, I think. And so I think we're looking for sort of late summer, early fall. So we'll see exactly on the timing of that, but we're getting close to being ready to do that. So that will be some excitement coming up.
On the Space Show, that was Sarah Noble, the lead lunar scientist at NASA. Lunar Science.
Surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers like powdered charcoal to the sole and sides of my boots. But I can see footprint of my boots and the tread in the fine sandy particles.
Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Yes, the Space Show is pleased to announce a new 54-part series called Lunar Science. This is not about spaceships and astronauts. It is about the science to be done on and near the Moon during the Artemis Project and the supporting unmanned missions. To find these programs, visit space.southernfm.com.au. Then scroll down until you see the Lunar Science link. Once again, Lunar Science is available online at space.southernfm.com.au.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
This is the Space Show. Now, Gordon Cable is a specialist in aerospace medicine at the University of Adelaide. He spoke here in Melbourne about his speciality, yes, aerospace medicine. He's introduced to us by Mark Turblum.
Dr. Gordon Cable is a specialist in aerospace medicine, a senior aviation medical officer for both the Defence Force and the Royal Australian Air Force, and currently head of aerospace medicine training at the RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine. Gordon is also the founding chair of the Space Life Sciences Committee, and works tirelessly each year on top of his usual workload to convene our annual Humans in Space Bioastronautics course. He's a fellow of the Australasian College of Aerospace Medicine, the Aerospace Medical Association, the Royal Aeronautical Society, the International Academy of Aviation and Space Medicine. Additionally, he's a clinical associate professor at the School of Medicine at the University of Adelaide and a senior lecturer at the University of Tasmania. In 2005, he was appointed a member of the Order of Australia for his contributions in the area of aerospace medicine. His professional interests are in altitude physiology of hypoxia and hyperbaric decompression illness, hypoxia awareness training for military and civilian air crews, that's lack of oxygen for anyone who's not familiar with the word, and postgraduate education in aerospace medicine for many medical professionals where he's a mentor for myself and many, many of my colleagues. Gordon will be speaking about the effects of the space environment on the human body. I'd like to start with a question, though. This is a question for you guys. When did humans first reach the moon? What year did we do that? Can we call out? 67? Got a 67? Any further thoughts? Reaching the moon. So most people, when you ask that question, what do you think they would say? It's with the 50th anniversary this year, right? So Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong's first foot on the moon, one giant leap for mankind. We first reached the moon in 1959. It was Lunik 2. It was a Russian probe. But which one does everyone remember? The human mission. Because you frequently hear the question, why do we bother sending humans to space? Why do we go to the moon? We heard a lot about robotics and mining in the last session. Why do we need humans to go at all when we have these autonomous systems and these robots that can do it for us? And I think I just answered that question, because people remember the human exploration aspects, and it's part of our nature to be explorers and to ask what's over the next hill and to send humans, because there is nothing that beats that human experiential actually being there. But it is challenging. So I want to ask you the question, then, how can we survive on the moon? If we choose to go, how do we survive? And there are a number of challenges involved in that. I'm going to touch on a few of them, and my colleagues in the panel are going to mention a number of these challenges as well as we go through this session. But NASA defines the biggest challenges they see in deep space exploration as those. So altered gravity fields, isolation and confinement, hostile closed environments, the distances that we are now looking at, and radiation, deep space radiation. This is going to be different now if we go to the moon and if we go beyond the moon to Mars. We've been locked in low Earth orbit now since Apollo. We haven't really left low Earth orbit. That environment is entirely different once we go beyond the magnetosphere of the Earth and we are suddenly in deep space and we're faced with planetary exploration of these other bodies. So I'm going to touch on some of these issues. One of the most challenging things NASA and ESA and other agencies have to face is to try and work out how we protect humans from radiation. The radiation in space is far different to what we experience on the surface of this planet and what astronauts experience on the ISS in low Earth orbit. They have some protection there. They're actually not completely out of the atmosphere, interestingly. They're in the thermosphere of the atmosphere. They're within the Earth's magnetic field, which protects them. They get more radiation than Earth, but it's not as bad as deep space. Earth is an unusual situation. We live in a bunker. The entire universe is bathed in radiation. That's the normal situation. We're the exception. We live in this shielded bunker, and as soon as we leave that shielded bunker, we are suddenly exposed to radiation from the sun in greater amounts than what we experience here because of our atmosphere and magnetic field. And there's galactic cosmic radiation, which comes from energized gas clouds and supernova explosions throughout the galaxy that spews out radiation ionized particles at very high energy, high velocity. So it's a very different environment and very challenging for human physiology to cope with all of that. From the moon's perspective, we're going to be exposed primarily to more radiation from the sun, which comes at us at fairly low velocity, but in high flux. So they tend to be positively charged protons, alpha particles, which are essentially a helium nucleus, and there's this constant background solar wind, as we call it. But from time to time, there is a solar flare. There is a large solar particle event, which is sufficient radiation to cause acute radiation sickness for astronauts. During the Apollo era, we were very lucky. We missed one of those events by a matter of days or weeks during one of the Apollo missions. The astronauts got home in time. But on the moon, that's going to be a potential problem of exposure. The lucky thing is we have warning time. The exposure takes time to get to us and to the moon. There's sufficient time, hopefully, to get astronauts into a shelter. The galactic cosmic radiation is ubiquitous. It's coming at us from all directions, every direction in space. We are protected to some extent by the planetary shielding effect. So on the moon, we're protected from half of it by the fact we're on a planetary surface. Half the radiation from one direction is shielded by the rock of the moon, which is great. So you'd probably expect to see maybe 1.5 to 2 times the radiation exposure that astronauts currently see on the ISS. Partial gravity. Everybody knows that we go to space, we're weightless on the ISS, but that's not true on the moon.
We've got 1/6 Earth gravity on the moon, and we really don't have a lot of experience with 1/6 gravity. We have absolutely zero experience with 3/8 gravity, which is what we'll feel on Mars. We have lots and lots of experience with microgravity. And I don't say zero G because there's no such thing as no gravity. In that constant free-fall environment of the ISS, you're in a microgravity environment, and we've done a lot of research on how that affects your physiology. But how many people have walked on the moon in history? You know? 12. 12 humans have been in 1/6 gravity in the entirety of human history, and they were only there for a few days. It was a camping trip compared to what we're currently contemplating, seriously. So we need to learn a lot more about what that actually means, how we deal with it. Gravity affects humans in very, very serious ways. It affects our blood pressure. It affects the way that our reflexes work to maintain blood pressure. It affects the way our heart pumps blood around the body because the heart deconditions if it doesn't have to work so hard. The fluids shift around. Getting to the moon's a 3-day trip, but going to Mars is going to be 7 months of microgravity. And one of the biggest problems we're facing at the moment, and we think it's a gravity problem, is that the astronauts' eyes and their eyesight deteriorate in microgravity. And it's a permanent change when they come back to Earth. It doesn't recover. They end up with nearsightedness. It's like the presbyopia you get with age where you can't read the fine print. And there's a lot of research going on at the moment to try and work out how we fix that, and we don't really know whether that's going to be a problem in lunar gravity. Hopefully not. I think, as they say, some gravity is better than no gravity. But the other problem is bones and muscles. Muscles waste away, they atrophy in microgravity, and in partial gravity, similarly, we don't have to lift as much. We're not loaded as much. Our anti-gravity muscles don't have to work as hard, so they don't bother. They just waste away. Bones demineralise, calcium washes out of bones, and we end up with a condition very similar to what we see in patients on Earth with osteoporosis. The bone demineralisation, the calcium washes out, the bones get thinner, and once astronauts return to Earth, it does take months and months sometimes to recover the normal bone architecture. Now, the best way to fix this is exercise. And at the moment, astronauts exercise for 2 hours a day, every day, on the ISS to maintain healthy bones and healthy muscles and healthy hearts. And it's a great countermeasure. It works really well. But you know what? We don't know what to prescribe in terms of exercise in a 1/6 gravity environment because we have no experience with that. So there's a lot of work going on in how we exercise, even how we locomote about the planet. We don't know how we're going to effectively move about on the planetary surface. The big problem is gravity transitions. If you're in microgravity for a long time and then you come back to even a partial gravity field, it's very difficult to walk, it's difficult to see, you feel dizzy, you feel motion sick, your blood pressure may not be quite so good, and it takes a few days to recover from that. For the moon, this may not be such a big issue, 3 days, so what? But Mars, 7 months, there is a high likelihood that astronauts will need to live in the lander as a habitat for probably 3 or 4 days to get their Mars legs before they adapt from a balance and posture point of view until they get their cardiovascular reflexes back a little bit, and then they can start ambulating and doing what they need to do. It's the transitions that are the problem. If we went to space and never came home, we'd stay adapted to microgravity and it wouldn't be a problem. But the thing is, we want to bring our astronauts back healthy. Lunar dust is another big problem. You've probably all heard of coal miners' lung, silicosis. There is a problem with lunar dust, we think, from a medical point of view. It's toxic stuff. The Apollo astronauts experienced some of this. You can see the dust stuck on that spacesuit, that EVA suit. It got into the LEM. It caused in some of the astronauts a problem that got called lunar hay fever. It had streaming eyes, coughing, sneezing, these respiratory symptoms, which were probably as a result of this dust, which is very, very fine, like talcum powder, but highly corrosive. There's no weathering forces on the moon. The dust is sharp-angled, corrosive. It erodes seals and mechanical parts. It sticks to solar arrays. It levitates from the lunar surface and sticks to everything because of electrostatic charge. The ionizing radiation bombarding the lunar surface electrostatically charges the dust. It levitates a couple of meters above the surface, sticks to everything. That's going to be a hard problem that we've got to try and mitigate. We're going to need to do some really good occupational medicine in terms of environmental monitoring, biological monitoring, respiratory function testing, monitoring astronauts' lungs to make sure this is not a problem, because potentially it could be a big problem. This stuff, we've known from recent studies, kills cells in cell cultures. So brain cells and lung cells die when exposed to lunar dust. So we have to be very careful about how we mitigate that risk. The other problem is the pressure on the moon. Now, we, you know, on the ISS have pretty much sea level pressure, sea level temperature, sea level oxygen concentration. The only problem, the only difference with the ISS environment is it's a microgravity environment. It's the gravity that's different. So it's a laboratory for microgravity. On the moon, it's a hard vacuum. There is no atmosphere at all. To do EVA on the moon, you need to be inside your own personal little spaceship. So that EVA suit has to be able to support oxygenation and pressure for human beings. Without oxygen, we become hypoxic, our brains don't work. As pressure decreases, nitrogen bubbles out of our system, and we can end up with decompression illness or sickness. And even worse than that, if we're exposed to extremely low pressure, water vapour in the body starts to vaporise and form bubbles in a condition that we call ebullism. So if a suit depressurised like that, you know, on the surface of the moon, if there was a slip, trip, fall, breach of the suit integrity, an astronaut would only literally have a matter of seconds, probably up to a maximum of a minute potentially, based on some research done with accidental exposures to vacuum, before they would succumb and die. So it's a very hostile environment. And we need to also think about how we mitigate the risk of decompression illness, where EVA is going to be very different now. EVA, extravehicular activity, is going to be on a contingency basis. We're doing a lot more of it because we're exploring. On the ISS, it's outside maintaining the station, highly planned, lots of preparation. You only do a few of them. But on the moon and on Mars, we're going to be in and out of a habitat or lander, constantly exploring, mining, constructing, whatever it is that we're doing, which means pressure transitions from habitat to suit back to habitat are going to be frequent and predisposing to decompression illness more than we've ever seen before with EVA activities on the International Space Station. The way to mitigate that is by varying the pressures in the habitat. So currently it is being looked at, for instance, to use what we call exploration atmospheres. So living in an atmosphere which is lower pressure but oxygen enriched, which helps wash nitrogen out of your body, and the transition from a habitat pressure to a suit pressure is a much less traumatic transition. Suits like that, Apollo suit and the ones currently used on the ISS, the pressure in the suit is 4.3 pounds per square inch. On the surface of the planet here, it's 14.7. It's equivalent to about 30,000 feet of altitude, and they're exposed to that altitude for many, many hours during an EVA. Interestingly, on the space station, we have had absolutely zero incidents of decompression illness problems. I contend that when we start ambulating on the surface of a planet where there is much more motion, movement, lifting and work going on, that the risk of that will increase. At the moment, we have no way of treating that on the ISS. So that's a bit of an overview of some of those environmental considerations for lunar operations. Why do we need people on the moon when we have robots with all these risks that are attendant upon it? Well, I think it's because robots need to be maintained. Even if we did purely robotic operations, there will need to be humans there to assist the robots, even if not in great numbers. But apart from that, it's purely the exploration, I think, that's important. We have in our genes, in our DNA, a need to explore, and I think we will continue to do that up to and including the lunar surface, Mars and beyond.
Addressing the Moon Village Association at Deakin Edge and Federation Square, that was Gordon Cable, a specialist in aerospace medicine at the University of Adelaide.
88.3 Southern FM.
On air and online via the free Community Radio Plus app. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play.
On this evening's Space Show, we are looking at the Artemis 1 mission, the first of the Space Launch System flights, and the science that's going on it. Now, Craig Hardgrove is the principal investigator for a CubeSat called Lunar HMAP. Now, he is assistant professor at School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. He describes Lunar HMAP.
All right, thanks so much for having me, and I'm excited to talk to you guys about LunaMap today. So LunaMap is an example of a new type of NASA mission, and it's much smaller than the traditional NASA missions that you might be used to. So I'll talk about sort of the evolution of this type of spacecraft and where LunaMap fits in, and hopefully kind of leave you with some of the things that I think might be exciting that these types of spacecraft can do in the future. But just to give you a sense, so this box here is the size of about two large cereal boxes that you might buy at the grocery store. the circular unit that you can see sort of pointing at you at the base of the spacecraft is it's a gimbaled thruster. So that's about the size of a tissue box that you might have in your house. And that contains solid iodine that we heat and shoot out the back of the spacecraft to provide very low thrust that enables us to get into lunar orbit with this very small spacecraft. And then inside this box, we have the primary instrument payloads, the only instrument, which is a neutron detector, which I'll tell you about. We have a deep space radio. We have a command and data handling system that includes reaction wheels, a star tracker. We have batteries, power management system. And you can see the solar arrays deployed there, which are actually, they rotate on a small gimbal so that we can keep them pointed at the sun during operations. So all of the large components that you would expect to find on a normal NASA mission, full size, you know, school bus size spacecraft, are in here. You just lose the size and you lose redundancy. Often those missions have multiple layers of redundancy throughout. And on a mission like this, you don't have the mass, the power, the volume for those types of things. So this is just all around a new type of mission, but it's very small and it can be accommodated on many different launch vehicles. So we actually just were placed onto the NASA mission, the Science Mission Directorate's, quote, fleet charts, what they call it. So all of their science missions are listed here throughout the solar system. And just for the moon, Luna Map appears. And as of, I think, last week, there's another small spacecraft called Lunar Trailblazer, which will also make an appearance on this chart. We're talking about a very, very small spacecraft. 10 centimeters by 20 centimeters by 30 centimeters is the main dimensions for the spacecraft body. And we have a science objective of mapping hydrogen enrichments within and outside permanently shadowed regions. That's what is called PSRs there, at the lunar south pole at spatial scales of less than 20 square kilometers. This would improve upon the maps that were made previously by Lunar Prospector, and it would complement the maps that have been made by Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LEND, which is also another neutron detector that was sent to orbit the moon. And in order to achieve the mission, we have to demonstrate deep space propulsion navigation in order to get ourselves into orbit around the moon, and we have to operate the spacecraft and collect our science data in orbit around the moon. I'll talk about just the science and where this fits in. So these are a few of the neutron detector missions that have carried neutron detectors to planetary bodies in the solar system. In the upper left is the Dawn mission, which mapped Ceres and Vesta and the hydrogen enrichments throughout the surfaces of those planetary bodies. In the top middle is Mars Odyssey, which also carried a neutron detector, made global maps of Mars water. You can see both the poles in those maps. The upper right is a messenger mission to Mercury. We also saw polar hydrogen enrichments at the South Pole of Mercury, or sorry, the North Pole of Mercury. On the bottom two images are Lunar Prospector and Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which carried neutron instruments to the moon. And like I've been mentioning, the purpose of sending a neutron detector into orbit around another planetary body is to map hydration. And the primary hydration-bearing molecule is water in the solar system, whether that's ice or liquid water. In most of these cases, it's ice. And so we map the planetary body usually at a regional scale. Regional meaning these instruments are not optical. You can think of them like a Geiger counter. So they're really mapping at the scale of, you know, tens to hundreds of kilometers. It's proportional to the altitude that the spacecraft is orbiting above the surface. So the closer you can get the spacecraft to the surface, the higher resolution or spatial resolution of the map that you can make. Most of these spacecraft didn't want to get very low to the surface because they carry many science instruments that don't want to do that, or it's a risky maneuver. So if you're not familiar with neutron detectors, really, the fundamental principle is that galactic cosmic rays are bathing the entire solar system in high-energy protons. If you don't have a thick atmosphere, those high energy protons get down all the way to the surface, and they create high energy neutrons in the surface. Interactions of those high energy protons with the nuclei that are in the planetary surface. And when you generate high energy neutrons, they really just bounce around, like you could think of them like ping pong balls. If a ping pong ball hits another ping pong ball, it loses about half of its energy. If a ping pong ball hits a bowling ball, it really just bounces off in the opposite direction and retains its kinetic energy. So that's the principle behind mapping hydrogen with a neutron detector. If you can make a map of the low energy component of the neutrons that are leaking out of a planetary surface, it's a great proxy for how much hydrated material is beneath the detector. Okay, so lunar water, don't expect to find a lake or even an ice skating rink. It seems likely that, or probable, that most of this hydrogen that we're talking about is adsorbed between grains, and it's been remobilized over time into these regions of permanent shadow. Gets deposited on the surface of the moon through water-bearing comets or asteroids. And the places that it's stable of the south pole of the moon, and this is a crater rim, almost no light gets into the crater itself. And so these regions are some of the coldest in the entire solar system. We're talking about negative 400 degrees Fahrenheit or colder. And so these are the only real places on the moon, which has no atmosphere, where we would find water to be stable. And that's where we do see with many of the other instruments that we've sent, enrichments, you know, signs of enrichments of water and water ice within these regions of permanent shadow. Neutron detectors integrate down to a meter. And so we can see if there's an enrichment in these hydrated phases down to a meter, which is a unique capability of these detectors. So here's our 282 ground tracks. We'll be in a 4.76-hour orbit. It's a highly elliptical orbit. That's the only way we can maintain a stable orbit with our relatively weak or very weak propulsion system, low thrust. So we execute periodic trajectory correction maneuvers at Apolloon when we're going the slowest, and make sure that we just control for the altitude. So the spacecraft is controlled either up or down to make sure that we aren't too weakly captured by the moon, or that we don't obviously impact with the moon. And then we let the argument of periaps sweep across the moon throughout the 2 months of the science mission. So to summarize some of the science objectives, there may be these thick subsurface ice deposits pervasive at high latitudes, and it may be that they're remobilized by impacts and then buried. There's some morphologic evidence to suggest that in these simple craters, and then it's possible that through impact gardening, you've vertically redistributed the ice, and that it's still stable in the top meter that, you know, outside of these regions of permanent shadow. And so that's in some ways very important to understand, and just as important to understand as the, you know, how much ice is within the regions of permanent shadow themselves. So, okay, so just now to finish up, just talking some about the LunaMap spacecraft. We're 14-kilogram spacecraft. The solar arrays, they are stowed. We go into a deployer when we're stowed into the rocket, and then the deployer opens, and we are pushed out on a push plate that's spring-loaded. And when we deploy, those arrays spread out, and when they're deployed, they're about a meter to a meter and a half wide. So they're very large arrays, and they're intended to power the propulsion system. So we get about 90 watts beginning of life for those arrays. The propulsion system uses about 65 watts when it's thrusting. And so those arrays need to be sun-pointed to power the propulsion system during our cruise and transition into lunar orbit. We will collect data at higher altitudes as we approach perilune. We do want to get some of the dry lunar highlands material so that we have a baseline for dry regolith count rates to compare the polar data to. We'll also collect data at Apolloon, primarily for background corrections that need to be made throughout the mission. But the data that we would collect at higher altitudes than, you know, plus minus 75 south, shouldn't be any better spatial resolution than what was acquired with Lunar Prospector or Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So, and we may not have the power budget on the spacecraft to keep the detector on for those portions of the orbit. So, like I mentioned, we really only intend to have it on for about 20 or 30 minutes each orbit at Paraloon. And then the spacecraft has a lot of maintenance and charging the batteries and other activities that it needs to complete that might preclude us keeping the detector on throughout each orbit. So I think the short answer is...
Yes, the short answer is he's looking for water on the moon. That's Craig Hardgrove, the Lunar HMAP principal investigator from the Arizona State University. Now, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pam Clark is the principal investigator of Lunar Ice Cube. Yes, she's also looking to find water on the moon.
Hi, yeah, I'd like to just give a quick update on what's going on with Lunar Ice Cube. You know, our motivation for making an instrument that required a crowd cooler, a very big challenge for a CubeSat, a 6U CubeSat, is that we wanted to cover the 3-micron band based on early results. And we also believe, based on other work done with M3 data, that we will potentially see water even at relatively low latitudes. So we are basically looking at water as a function of time of day. We have a repeat pattern that allows us to go back over the same swaths about once a lunar cycle, about once a month or so. Expect to see probably something like 10% of the lunar surface at two or more times a day. So our basically our operational strategy is we take data about every half second or so. We have overlapping 10-kilometer fields of view as we are close in altitude. We also have the option of either changing the field of view or keeping it, making it larger so that we increase our effective signal noise ratio as we go toward the pulse. We have a nearly polar orbit. Lunar Ice Cube is the most operationally complex CubeSat to date. We provide measurements on water absorption features, including liquid water in various forms, ice on hydroxyl, as a function of time of day. We'll also cover regions that are known well on the moon, get a sense of what happens as a function of latitude, and different types of terrains on the moon. And are we doing what CubeSats are supposed to do, creating an innovative and tailored solution with a standard platform?
And we'll have more about Artemis 1 on next week's The Space Show.